Northeast Archives of Folklore and Oral History, accession number 2196, tape number C778.
Friday, the 9th of March, 1990, and I am in Rancho Peñasquitas, California, in the home of Mr. William Finch, and I am speaking to him. Okay. First of all, what capacity were you sailing in during the war? I mean, where did you start and what did you end up as?
Well, I started as a utility man. Well, first I went to Sheepshead Bay in New York, but you've heard of that. And I took the engine course, and then when I finished, there was no ships in, and they said, well, we have a opening for three utility men. So I and two other men accepted these jobs as utility men. And so that's what I did on my first voyage. And then on the next voyage, I was a farm and water tender. And then I did four more voyages in World War II, and I was an oiler on each one of those voyages.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can tell you what type of ships they were, if you want to know that.
What union were you with?
I was the National Maritime Union.
You were NMU. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. That's fairly... It's funny, I think more of the deck people I've talked to have been SUP, but more of the engine people I've talked to have been NMU.
Yeah. Well, in those days, and maybe today too, that they wouldn't like black men join SUP.
Oh, was that it?
Yeah, so that might have some...
I didn't realize, because I thought SUP was pretty liberal.
Well, I don't know. I haven't talked with them since... On the first voyage date, I had him. I was with him.
No, but that's the first piece of that information that I've had. I'm interested to have it.
Yeah, but we understand there are strictly deck people in SUP, but NMU has all departments in one union. It's an industrial union, and SUP and SIU and Marine Firemen, Oilers, and Water Tenders are all separate unions, like crafts. Each one has its own craft. That's what I want. So anyway, the NMU gave me more opportunity than the others did. So that's what's
well going good. I'm glad you went with the one that gave you the best opportunity.
Yeah, because when I started out, I wanted to work in the engine room anyway. When I went to Sheepshead Bay in the first place, so I did. So I have no complaint about that. Yeah.
Okay, you went to Sheepshead Bay. Where were you originally from?
Well, I was living in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh, so you...
And so then in 1943, I went to Sheepshead Bay. Because it's a short, about 90 miles away.
How old were you?
I was 22.
Oh, you were one of the older crowd.
Yeah. Right, more than older.
Yeah,
than
I've run into a lot of guys that started when they were 17, 18.
Yeah, right.
And you... remained unlicensed.
Yes. Well, after the war, they had a school for electricians, which I qualified for, had enough time. Then they gave a lot of people went there to apply, and they said, well, there's more than people here than what we have openings for. Oh, the requirement was you had to have a certain amount of time as an oiler. I forget how long, a year or something. And so then they gave an examination of mathematics, which I passed, and then, so I was one of the ones that took the electrician school. So then after the war, I did two voyages as an electrician. And I was in 46, but at that time, though, there was still a crisis. The War Shipping Administration sent me a letter and asked me to continue to sail because they had to bring soldiers home from overseas, and they want to send relief supplies to Europe, things like that. And so I went on some more, you know. So finally, by the end of 46, I stopped. But I did do two voyages as an electrician. And that's how I was unlicensed. I was still unlicensed.
But it was a higher...
It was more pay, yeah. And less work. Right?
More prestigious.
More prestigious, yeah. and speaking of documents, let me show you this one over here.
Oh, there's your your Shellbeck certificate.
Yeah, I've seen these before.
Yeah, this was my first one.
That's a particularly attractive one.
Yeah. Well, for years and years, it's just rolled up, and I said, well, I might as well get it out.
Oh,
and have
yes.
It preserved
I,
and
I certainly like think
that.
So.
Yeah. So anyway, it's got the name and the date and the latitude and the longitude. Longitude 100. That's west mm-hmm. of Panama.
Uh-huh. What was the ceremony like?
Oh, it was sort of it was an initiation. They had one guy dressed up as King Neptune. I guess you've heard this before.
Well, everybody's got a slightly different version. It depends on what some people say. Oh, well, yeah, I finally got a certificate, but we never had any ceremony at all. We were too busy. And then there are people that describe in detail the tricks and so forth that were played upon them.
Well, this was, they had a nice ceremony and a nice situation. Well, I think the reason was that this was a troop ship and had CBs, Navy CBs there. And so the CBs, I think, were the ones that got the forms and then they made it out after they got started. Because as far as the people I was working with, the storage department, we didn't know where we were going until after we left the U.S. Because first I joined in New York, joined the crew in New York, and then we said, well, from here we're going to go to Newport, Rhode Island. Didn't say for what. And so we went up there and we got CBs. And after we left Newport, said, well, we're going to New Guinea. So that's how we got through, went through the canal and got out there. So then the ceremony was that they made a, well, it had a real long tent. It's about as long as, say, about 20 feet long. And it's about 2 feet high and wide, so you can crawl through it. And then inside here, on the deck, they put garbage and stuff, you know. And so then one guy had shorts on and he had stuff painted. He had tattoos on his arm. I think he was, I forget whether it was a CB or a merchant marine or what. But anyway, he sat down and he was King Neptune. Then he had two guards, one on each side of him, and they were his court. So then they'd call your name. They had a list of all the crew's names. So they'd call your name and they'd report on it. The number four hatch, that's where it was. So you go up there, and then he said, well, since you came into King Neptune's territory, you have to go through an ordeal. And if you pass the ordeal, we'll give you a certificate or something like that, he says. So you had to crawl through this tunnel, which is a tent. And it wasn't very hard. Then when you come out, you wipe your hands, and then they'd give you this thing rolled up in a roll, and that's all there was to it.
That was all there was.
And so they over the public address system, they'd call everybody's name, two or three at a time, and then you go, take them about 10 minutes later, call some more until they got everybody. Yeah.
No fire hoses, no gooping up with lubricating oil.
No, I didn't get. Then you just got a little garbage on it. Also, it might have been oil on the deck, too, might have been.
All your clothes on?
Yeah, you can do it with your regular work clothes. Uh-huh.
Because I've heard of some guys that had to take all their clothes off, and then they stuck stuff on them.
Oh,
painted them.
Oh, so they had a big cleanup job.
Oh, yeah.
Well, then I went across the equator on my second voyage, and they didn't do anything.
To anybody.
Did nothing, did
I
it?
Mean, they wouldn't have done it to you because you'd already been initiated.
Yeah, they didn't even say when they went across the equator. Just ignored it altogether. And so anyway, that's the way that was. So, yeah, go ahead. So you got any...
What did you do in your copious free time? No, when you were off watch, what did you do for recreation? Play cards, read.
Well, I'd read. I played checkers. Sometimes I'd have conversations with other people, and the people who ate meals with you. You know, these about the same people you see every day. So I'd talk with them. We'd get in a conversation, talk about past voyages or whatever.
And people you had checkers aboard.
Checkers. Yeah, I didn't play cards much. I'd play checkers. Yeah.
I've heard of a lot of guys that played cribbage.
Cribbage yeah.
Seems to be the big thing in some areas.
Yeah.
Especially among the gun crews. Gun crews like
I guess
cribbage.
Is that right? Oh, you've met some of them.
Uh-huh.
That's nice. Yeah.
Oh, I've been
looking to get as many different areas as possible, because what I'm doing is trying to give the history of the convoys from the standpoint of what it was like to be on them, rather than dates and times and cargoes and, you know, I mean, that's important too, but it's not as human interesting.
Okay, well, I'd like to tell you some, I could tell you some human interest stories.
Oh, please do.
Well, when the first crew I was with was the, I was the utility man. Let me get into that.
What ship was that?
This was the first ship. This was Alcoa Patriot.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there were three of us were sheepheads. They call us sheepheads. And so, after they said, one guy was, he knew the ship was a troop ship, and he was a professional gambler, and he had a big roll of bills, which I found, because when he'd go to take a shower, he had me hold it for a while for him, you know, until he came back from the shower. So anyway, one of the other sheephead guys says, will we have to go through the canal, or will we go around the Cape Horn? So the gambler says, well, even an idiot should know that we have to go through the canal. So then one of the other guys, who's a sort of peacemaker, sort of, and sort of fatherly type, he's older too, fatherly type guy, kind of bawled him out and said, well, we're going to have to be together several months, we should try to get along, and this is a reasonable question I asked, and she should get answered in a civil way and everything. So then he apologized, you know. But he'd been to Murmansk, a couple of them had been, and a couple of others had been to Murmansk, they thought they were superior to this the person making the first trip or something, you know.
Speaking of people making first trips, were there any fool's errands that the newcomers were regularly sent on?
No. Well, it might have been. I didn't get caught into any of that.
None of the golden rivet bucket of steam stuff.
No, nothing like that. I had experienced some of that on a job I had on shore, so I was suspicious of any strange errands, might say. Yeah, that I'd heard of it. That, but not on this particular ship. That didn't do that.
Let's see.
Okay, so then the next thing. So the three utility men and the assistant steward, they worked together. We were sort of at the extra ones that were there to help meet the needs of the Seabees, and so. Before we left New York, they took the crew's mess room and converted it into a storeroom, took the tables and benches out, and put them down in the number three hole, and had a stairway going down to number three hole, and the crew's mess room was in the number three hole. And then the mess room was, they put a lot of all kind of supplies in there. So then after about second day out, well, this fatherly, same fatherly type guy is telling me, he said, well, if the assistant steward doesn't stop working, he's going to have a nervous breakdown. I said, why? He says, well, he and the supply officer of the CBs are trying to get their supply straightened out, because in the new storeroom, they got them mixed up. They just put a lot of stuff in there. So
they just teased it all and didn't pay any attention to which was which.
So they had one storeroom down in the number three hole and one up on the main deck where the crew's mess room was. So about the third night out, well, the assistant steward came and got the three utility men and said, well, I've been looking for 2 days for this canned ham, and I found it. At least I smell it. So anyway, we had to take linen and put it down, go downstairs, put it in the linen room. And we had a lot of boxes of apples to put them in the refrigerator. Was a walk-in refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
And where the fruit were, apples and oranges, that was about 60 degrees or so. Then I had where the meat was, that was frozen, whatever, 30, I guess. So it took us about half, finally we got to the where the cans of ham were, and some of them they're 5-pound cans, and they were kind of cracked, some of them cracked open. But on their cans said keep refrigerated, but they got warmed up. We're going south towards to the Caribbean Sea. So so we had to throw it all out. I had to throw out about 100 cans.
Oh.
So then...
just because some joke had loaded it wrong.
Just they loaded up just quick as they...
You lost your hand, that's a shame.
Well, we didn't run out of food, but the would have been nice to have some canned ham, you know.
No, I didn't expect you'd run out of food.
Yeah.
Merchant ships, especially when they were transporting troops, were fairly well supplied.
Right.
But it's a shame you lost your ham.
Right.
What was the climate aboard as regarded racial interaction?
Well, we kind of got used to each other. We spent more time talking with the CBs than we did with the crew. Because after the ham episode, my job was to help bring up a sack of potatoes. Well, we'd bring up two sacks. So they'd have one guy was a pot washer. He worked in the galley. He wasn't a cook. He was just learning. He
Scullery
wanted to learn
boy.
To cook. Cellar, yeah. So he'd bring up a sack of potatoes, and I'd bring him a sack. Then I'd had a job. I'd issue out the cans of vegetables that they needed for each meal. That, you know, they'd have. Well, they'd always have potatoes, and then have a choice of maybe beets one day and one meal or meat, or string beans or maybe cauliflower, but it'd be canned. And the potatoes were fresh, so they'd prepare them every day.
Canned cauliflower?
Well, maybe, I don't know about cauliflower, but the beets and string beans, I remember that. Yeah, but that was canned. I wouldn't swear about cauliflower. I might have been.
Carrots or something.
Yeah, right. And that was all I would do. I'd just, I'd bring up the potatoes, and then I'd, for the noonday meal and evening meal, I'd have the keys, I'd open it up and put out some, however many cans I needed. So after several days, I said to one of the older guys, I said, you know, you're a big help to the steward, because you just give out as much as enough for the meal, no more. I said, well, yeah, I might as well do it right. The problem, or what they wanted to do, they wanted to give extra meals out to the CBs, and then in exchange, the CBs would wash the dishes for them. You know? But I wasn't in sympathy with that, because we'd thrown away some food already, the messmen, they could wash it up in 10 or 15 minutes anyway. So it was no reason to be wasting food, you know. Because the CBs only got two meals a day. But if they're on sentry duty, then they'd get three meals. But the rank and file, if they weren't on sentry duty, they would get two meals a day. Well, the sentries are just like monitors. They just keep order. Mm-hmm. And they take, I don't think they had the same guys all the time. They take turns.
Rotated,
right.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad I wasn't a CBA, though I don't usually eat more than two meals a day.
Well, they had to stand in line so long they couldn't, would have been hard work to give them three meals, you know. And they could survive on two, because they weren't doing it, you know, most of the time. So it was really, once I got used to it, it was not a hardship. So anyway, then we went through the Windward Passage. You've heard of that, haven't you? Okay, between Cuba and Haiti.
Yeah.
And then we went to Panama, and when we got on the Pacific, went through the canal. That was very interesting. And when we got on the Pacific side, they said, well, we're going to have to stay over here a day or two because the anchor motor, something's wrong with that. So we had the chance to go ashore in Panama City. That was interesting. And then we left and went on across the Pacific 20 days until we got to New Guinea. So then, after we stopped in Milne Bay. This was in Milne Bay about 2 months, about 2.5 months, all of January, February, March, and left in April. Got back to San Francisco in April, but we stayed there so long because the CBs, they lived on board while they're barreling accommodations, barracks on shore. So they would have a work party just go ashore, and so we're there at the time. And so then the CPs, they had a movie projector, and they'd show movies.
That was handy.
Yeah, because the Japanese, the Air Force, and Navy was so far away from New Milne Bay that it was safe. They got on number 4 deck, and on the back of the deck house, they'd just use that as a screen, and they'd show movies. So every day they'd come and tell us what movie was going to be and see everybody's welcome to come. So we'd go and look. So finally they ran out of the movies, and... they were showing, they were going to show, so, well, today, tonight, we're going to show a picture on diesel engines. And, these other two guys that were utility men, they were black like me, and they'd taken the engine course at Chief Said Bay, too. And so, after CB's left, one of the guys said, well, he asked me, was I going to go to the course? I said, yeah. So there's another guy, black guy, young man. He was 18 or so. I said, well, you're going to go? And he said, well, no, what's the use? So then he said, well, hey, someday he'll be talking to me. You'll be an engineer. Finch will be an engineer, and you'll be just standing on the corner wondering what's happening. And so I said, okay, I'll go. But if it turns out like that, I wouldn't be jealous of his success. You know?
Well, that was nice of him, but I don't know. Finch will be an engineer, and you'll be a bum.
Yeah. So I don't know what his career was, but at least he did have his oiler's license, fireman's bartender license, and he did take an interest in the picture on diesel engines. So.
But you don't know what happened.
We exchanged names and addresses, and then I never did write, and he didn't write to me. And I should have wrote to him and encouraged after I made a couple of voyages, or even after the next voyage, I should have wrote, let him know I was still alive and working in the engine room, you know.
Yeah.
But then after it was all over with, then I thought of, well, I mean, after I decided to stop going to sea, I thought of it then, you know. But usually when I wanted to get back, I'd be interested in visiting my family and my girlfriends. I wouldn't be thinking about writing to, I'd write home, but as far as writing to a man or the man, that wasn't, didn't seem to be all that important, you know.
Well, it wasn't as much fun to get a letter from another man either.
Right. But from the point of view of trying to give him some encouragement, it would have been a good idea to do it, yeah.
Do you think that after taking the engine course, the reason that you were placed in the stewards department on your first voyage was because of your color?
I don't know. They said there's no ships out when we... no ships in port, I should say. No ships. So far as I could tell, it wasn't. As far as we just went first day, a couple of there, New York, a day and a half, two days, I think. Things look kind of vacant. They might have just been trying to get rid of us, you know. But I'd heard of the NMU before I went in, so when I came back from first trip, I you couldn't just join right off the bat. You had to make you'd be on probation, you have to work at least 3 months, and then they'd vote you in, you know. And so then they'd give you a card. The members would have a certain color, one color, I think it was green, and then the new people would have a pink card or some other color, two different colors.
Yeah.
So then if a job came up that you had a license for and then none of the regular members wanted it, then they'd give it to you, you know.
Uh-huh.
So that's how I got. My first job was a fireman water tender. Because I was there several, I was in, went around the hall about a week, and they'd be hiring different, you know, for all the license ratings. Not many, they didn't hire many bosuns. Bosuns didn't quit very much, I guess. But they did, there was a lot of hiring going on at Philadelphia NMU Hall. And finally I got hired there, through them.
Well, a lot of places, if they want a bosun, they just take a good AV that they already had and turn him into a bosun.
Well, that might have been what was happening, yeah.
At least from what I've heard from other guys.
Yeah.
You'd say, well, I sailed as an ordinary, and then I got my upgrade to AV, and then somebody came along and said, hey, we need a bosun. You want to be it?
Yeah, so then they got it. Well, because that brings us up to my second voyage. Okay, so that was on the Josiah Quincy. And
was she a Liberty?
Yeah, this was a Liberty. First ship, I don't know what it was. It was a freighter, all right. I think it was built before the World War II.
Well, if it was an Alcoa ship, it must have been an old ore ship to begin with.
Could have been, yeah. But it had five holes, three in at the head and two in the stern. And so anyway, okay, the Josiah Quincy was operated by the Black Diamond Steamship Company. So I first went on board and went up to the first assistant, and so he said, "Well, can you go to work right away?" It was about 10 o'clock in the morning.
And that was your first engine room job?
First engine room job. I said, "Yeah." I said, "That's what I was there for, to go to work." So he said, "Well, the guy down there now, he's been on duty since 12 o'clock, so, you know, he should have been relieved at 8, but nobody was there, so I went down." So I went down, he was white, so we talked a while. I'm going to find out he's from Virginia. And he shook hands, and the next thing I remember about him, besides being in Virginia, he said the ship was going to go to Baltimore, and he's going to quit when he got to Baltimore. And I said, "Well, you having problems?" He said, "No, I need a rest, you know." So I said, "Well, this is my first time on one of these." I didn't tell him right away that my first time working in an engine room, but at Sheepshead Bay, they had a full power plant up a Liberty ship, and it was a very good course they had there, I thought. So he said, "Well, whatever you do, don't let the steam pressures drop below, I think it's 175 pounds. It might have been 275. I forget the exact number now." And they had, on the steam gauge, they had a red hand set there, right? So you shouldn't let the pressure go below that. So I said, "Okay." So he left, and then they relieved me for lunch, and I worked out and worked, finished the day. And I looked all around, so I got familiar with everything. Because all the wheels they had the tag on to tell what it was. I mean, what the purpose. I mean, wheels where you open valves and close valves. They told what tank, supply tank or oil or whatever the case might have been. And it was a very easy job, I thought. Very easy. And because it was quiet. Because before this, I'd worked in the shipyard where it was very noisy. And I was a ship fitter's helper, and I had to be outside all day, every day. During the winter, I was out.
And the winter is always that great in Philadelphia.
Yeah. This was in Chester, Pennsylvania, where
we were
in the shipyard.
Enough.
Close enough, yeah. And we built T2 tankers. And that's the point there, too. Nowadays, they're putting out tankers without double bottoms. In those days, when it was a rush, it was a crisis, they still put double bottoms in World War II. And the Liberty ships had double bottoms, too. So anyway, they told me that the assistant wanted to see me again before I left. So I saw him. So he said, "Well, look," he says, "you live here in Philadelphia. You can go home tonight. And tomorrow morning, meet us at Pier 100. We were about Pier in the 40s. So this is about 3 miles away where they were going to go. So go meet us there in the morning, and then you can just go to work." I said, "Well, what time in the morning?" "So after breakfast, no rush." So I thought that was very nice of him, you know. So they moved. They moved, and so the next day I went down there. And so... The only thing that was difficult about this job was the steam pressure was always going up, or you couldn't adjust the flame so it would just stay even. And the reason for that was because the load wasn't constant. Because sometimes if somebody went into the big ice box, it would speed up, or men would slow down, or somebody used the restroom, a pump would start off, and they used deck machinery that would be increase the load. So the load went up, then the generators would speed up. No, it had one generating one. They had two, but only one would work, and one in reserve. So then when they used more electricity, the generator would speed up. That would cause to use more steam. So steam pressure would drop down a bit. So then you'd have to continually adjust the pressure. No, not continually, but every... You couldn't go an hour without adjusting the steam the flame in the boiler. So I said, "Well, I think I will... let it drop down to the red line, see what happens." I wouldn't let it go below the red line, so I let it sink down to see what happens. So while I was letting the steam pressure drop, well, three guys came down in uniform, and one of them was says, "Well, I'm the third assistant engineer, and I'm going to be on 8 to 12 watch with you," because I'd asked her that previously. And these other guys are cadets. They're going to the Officer Academy out in Long Island, New York.
Kings Point,
yeah. And so I'm gonna show them around. So they were walking around. So then when the steam pressure, it had a black hand, and of course had a red hand that they could set, and the black hand fluctuated. Is this too much detail for you?
No, I need to turn the tape over.
Okay.
I'm getting this little flashing red light, which handily is my gauge and tells me.